Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions.
Yeah, we're pretty opinionated.
We are.
And getting more so. We're in our 10th year of the show.
Who would have thought?
Plenty of time to develop opinions.
We were just consistent opinions. we were just talking about hearing our own voice on the radio. Even after 10 years, it's still kind of weird. But thank you for joining us. Thank you for being our audience today. We appreciate you as our audience, and we appreciate your support because KHOI is a community radio station, and we get by with your good wishes and your donations and your memberships. Well, I made some orange peels, Donna.
Bravo!
Your recipe, so I'm kind of sliding into
Christmas. Well, as I say, it's when the Christmas season begins, it's the first thing I make. It, like, signals to me, okay, the race is on. Because I put them in everything, and, you know, once you've got a pile of them in the pantry, you just keep...
And eating them.
Oh. This year was a disaster. The whole first batch, I left it out on the counter, and everyone in the house picked off. We ate the whole thing. I had to make another batch. So,
well, orange peels. It's the season.
Candied orange peels. So Lana brought in hers. It's good because I haven't eaten anybody's but my own for years. So,
they're wonderful. We'll see if they're gone by the end of the show.
These are fat oranges. What kind of oranges were they? Big old navel or something?
Big old navel. They weren't very pretty to look at.
No.
Also, there's one, I don't know if you can find it. There's one pineapple. Or not pineapple.
Not pineapple. What?
Grapefruit.
There's a grapefruit in here?
Poke around. I don't
How
know.
How can you tell?
I'm surprised. It all kind of smushed together. Today.
Oh, this looks like a grapefruit. Hold on.
Okay. It tastes like the same, right?
Well, because you boiled them both in the same syrup, right?
Yeah.
Well, but it's got that last... little grapefruit bitterness. Oh, love it.
It will be gone by the end of the
show. And what are you going to do with them?
Oh, I'm going to make some fruitcake, actually, this afternoon.
Oh, you're going to make fruitcake this year.
Yeah. Well, my usual spicy Mediterranean fruitcake.
Oh,
it's
yummy.
Heavy on the fruit and nuts, not so heavy on the cake. It's good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how that
goes. I'm going to make a citron cheesecake this year, and it's going to be topped with chopped orange peel.
Oh, don't you just love the holidays?
Yuzu jam and chopped orange peel.
Don't you just love the holidays?
And, by the way, the Meyer lemons are back in the stores, specifically at Wheatsfield. But that, you know, that means the season is starting. Here we go. Citrus.
Yay.
Yeah.
Well, today on the Danilana Kitchen, our thoughts will be heading south to Antarctica. Yes, you wouldn't have thought, but yes, we have a special guest joining us at the kitchen table today. Joining us is Monica Tucker. Welcome to our table.
Thank you, Lana. It's good to be here. Thank you, Donna.
Good. Well, Monica Tucker, I just met this nice woman a couple of years ago, and I have a little... She's got a lot to say about a lot of different places that she's lived and cooked and done interesting things. So Monica Tucker was born in California to first-generation German immigrants. She studied psychology, worked a summer in a bakery in Germany. She worked as a heavy equipment dispatcher in Antarctica.
Oh, that's what you were doing there.
Uh-huh. Lived and worked at...
I bet everything is heavy equipment down there.
At Buddhist Meditation Center and traveled a lot. She was kitchen manager at Spirit Rock Buddhist Center.
Wait, I have a question. Were you a Buddhist before you went down there or afterwards?
After, yeah. See? Yeah, I went traveling after Antarctica, and I ended up in Thailand and did a Buddhist retreat there.
Oh, I was going to guess that... Being in the Arctic Circle, the south one, contributed to you becoming a Buddhist. Talk about it, really limited environment.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I guess.
Who knows? Anyway, she's here in Ames. And a little disclosure now, I met Monica because I happened to know her significant other, who she met in a Buddhist center in Santa Cruz Mountains, where he was the center's handyman, and he is an Ames person, so I've known him for many years. And he came back from California with Monica, and I'm awfully glad he did. That's good. Well, let's cut to the chase, Monica. We have a lot of good things to talk about today. Okay. Let's talk about your experiences way down under. I mean, this is Southern culture. This is Southern cooking, and we forget that as we're losing the light up here, it's a little different down below.
It's summer down there now.
It's very different down below. And yes, it is summer. It's light 24 hours a day there at the moment. Let's see. What about cooking down under?
Well, first we have to clarify that Santa Claus does not live at the South Pole.
It's true. We have no Santa Claus there.
And what else did you say? No polar bears.
No polar bears. Okay. Those are strictly North Pole.
See, we have to clear this up because our people will ask, I'm sure. Yep, yep. But there are penguins.
There are penguins, yes, yes.
Are they kind of like running around like squirrels, or are they very, like rare to see them?
They're kind of rare. They're kind of way out on the sea ice, but then they get captured and put in these little, they're called like the penguin farm. And they'll drill a little hole in the ice that the scientists can study them,
habits. I thought maybe that was the meat dish in the South Pole. I don't know.
No penguin tacos there.
Okay. Oh, so, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't get to eat the wildlife. Except at Christmas time, we did get to eat the wildlife, but it was not the penguins.
What was it?
Antarctic cod.
Oh, fish. Okay.
Fish. Okay. Yeah. So people would go out fishing and get massive amounts of cod to feed 1,000 to 1,200 people at Christmas time.
So the cod is still fairly plentiful down there?
Well, 20 years ago it was. I don't know about now.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, cod is one of those fish that they're restricting, hoping that they will regenerate and grow, particularly in the North Atlantic. I have no idea about the Arctic Circle, but...
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you used to think about the South Pole is at the tail end of nowhere because it was pretty uninhabitable. But you mentioned there's quite a hefty bunch of popes in there. What are they doing?
Right. What are all those people doing there? So at McMurdo Station, where I was stationed, which is not directly at the South Pole.
Is this American government stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The it's National not international. Science Foundation.
Oh, then... Science.
Yeah, yeah. So there are, I believe there are, I think it's 29 countries that have a space in Antarctica, but nobody owns Antarctica. So, of course, the U.S. has the biggest presence there. So they have three stations, one's at McMurdo, one's at the South Pole, and the other one is, you have to get there through Chile.
Are these all non-military? They're all scientific?
Right. Used to be military. Used to be the Navy that was stationed down in Antarctica.
So, no more.
No more.
Well, yeah. That's nice to hear there's some progress in the pacifist direction somewhere on the planet.
Yeah. Oh. It doesn't sound like something you'd want to fight over, but you never know.
There's probably nothing left on Earth that somebody's not willing to fight over.
Oh, dear. So, right. So Monica, when you went down there to work... And when you first got there, what did you notice? You said probably a little different than where you came from.
Yes, very different. So when you're in New Zealand, you fly to New Zealand first, and then you're there for a night or two, and then you take off on an Air Force cargo plane. So as you're getting on the plane, they hand you a sack lunch and a set of earplugs, and you've got your big parka on and your big white bunny boots, they call them, the big white snow boots, and you're sitting next
and
to
this is somebody. everybody wears this.
You get your gear in they call it the CDC, the Clothing Distribution Center in New Zealand, in Christchurch, New Zealand.
So not only are you in a totally white space, but everyone is wearing the same clothing.
They are. They're wearing these big red parkas. So you have your name tag on it. Mm-hmm. You have your Velcro name tag.
Okay.
Because you don't get to keep the outfits when you leave. So yeah, you're wearing this outfit. You're on this plane and it's really loud. There's like one little window and you're riding together for like 5 hours. And if the weather's bad, they'll do a boomerang and they'll fly you back to New Zealand, which I never had to do that. We landed, and I got off the plane, and the moon
was coming. This is some kind of prop
up.
Plane, right?
It's a C-141. It's Air Force cargo plane.
Is it? Yeah. Land in water?
It lands on the sea ice. So, yeah. Oh. It's very solid.
I know, but it must be very slippery. Oh, my God.
It is. Yeah, it can be. So you get off the plane, and it's kind of like being on Mars. You know, you're kind of wandering around, crunching on this sea ice, and everybody's wearing the same thing. And, California girl lands in Antarctica and wonders, are my lungs going to freeze? Is this okay?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah,
and
it was amazing.
So there, you mentioned thousands of people there. Did they stay there all year? It seems they get all kind of pasty and sad.
True. So the folks that winter over, So the summer season starts in October, and those people stay until about February, and then they take off. And then it becomes the winter overs. So maybe like 200 people stay over winter.
Ooh.
And they're there from February through October. And then there's this short period of time called winter fly-in or wind fly. And that's when I would fly in. And that was August. We'd fly in August and get the station ready for the summer. So there'd be like another 100 of us flying in to be with the winter overs. And we'd spend about 6 weeks getting the station ready. And during that time, it was 20 hours a day of darkness. And we would gain 20 hours a day, 20 minutes a day of daylight.
Ooh.
So it was really interesting to watch the light return. So we're there with those people that have been there all winter. And they're very pasty white. And their eyes are bloodshot. And they're moving really slowly.
Oh, my.
And so we're coming in all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, tanned. And so it's a really interesting
combination.
Do they
send those poor people home?
They do. Finally, in October, they get to go home. And those people, usually, they've started in October. So they've been there for a whole year. So they
need seasonal affective disorder,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, they need to get out of there. Yeah.
Ooh.
We referred to them as the winter toast. And they were very toasty.
Oh, dear. So, in this bunch of people, you worked as a heavy equipment dispatcher, which I'm sure anything that needs done needs to be moved in huge bunches because you're dealing with living quarters and building things and heaven knows. But
Yes. But
what's for dinner?
Right. What do we eat? So, oh my gosh. So the year that I was there, the bakers were incredible. They made wonderful bread and pastries. And so I ate a lot of that. And the rest of the food was okay.
It's easy to fly in the flour and the sugar, right?
It is. And that actually gets shipped in. So it's the fresh food that gets flown in while you're down there. And then there's a resupply vessel comes like in, I think, January or February, and it brings in sort of like the dry goods for the year.
Flour, sugar, and gasoline, I suppose, right?
Yes, yeah. A lot of fuel, huge fuel tank. So there's a refueling vessel that comes in and then the resupply vessel that brings in vehicles and food and big pieces of metal to build things. And, it's quite a production. So food. Let's see. What did we eat? Stuff out of the freezer. Lots of meat and, gosh, I don't even remember. I think,
potatoes.
What did we have? We had those little potatoes. What are those called? Tater tots. We had a lot of tater tots. So it was kind of like being in college again.
Oh.
Well, that's true because not only did they have to bring everything, but they have to accommodate median taste values, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
Nothing extreme. So it's, sure, feed everybody like children.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with that, right?
One of my favorite times was when they would, freshies would come in. So we called them freshies. So
fresh people or fresh fruits and vegetables?
Well, saying both. We would call the fresh people also freshies. But salad would come in, and so someone would know at the airport, and you know they would let other people know. They would call their
friends. Yeah, because you can't take it out in the freezing air for very long.
Right, you'd have to have a heated truck to pick up the fresh food to bring it back to the station, so that we could have unfrozen salad. Mm-hmm. And you better get to dinner early that night, or you're going to miss out on the freshies.
Yeah. He's probably starving for that.
Something to look forward to. Is there like one big kitchen? You mentioned that a lot of different countries have interests. Are there different kitchens, or you make your own, or how does it work?
Good question. So we just had one big kitchen at our station, mm-hmm. and each station has their own sort of kitchen, and some are out at field camp. So there's people actually cooking out at a field camp. So they're making like a makeshift kitchen for a season.
Those are the guys that were eating the penguins.
Could be, absolutely. Or the seals.
Oh, the seals. Oh, yeah, that is a little more traditional. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the seals will actually chew a little hole through the ice, and then they'll sort of pop up, and they just plop right on the ice. Yeah.
Oh, for goodness sakes. So, you did it for 2 years.
6 months at a time.
I did, 6 months at a time. Yeah, so I'd fly in the winter. And by October 21st, it'd be light 24 hours a day. So,
and you were doing this for fun and experience.
For fun and experience, absolutely.
How old were you?
I was 35. So at that time, the median age was about 35.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So
everybody's the same age, wearing the same clothes, with the same very interesting psychological experiment, you know?
Oh, I think it would be. Do you go outside just for fun? I mean, is there time when you can actually like go for a walk or anything, or is it just plain too bitter cold?
Oh, no, lots of outdoor fun.
Oh, yeah. Good. Really? Yeah. What?
Absolutely. So you could walk to, there was another station that the New Zealand folks ran, and that was like a 2 kilometer walk. So you could walk over to Scott Base is what it was called.
Visit the neighbors.
Visit the neighbors. There's a little hill they call the Observation Hill.
And what were the temperatures like?
Let's see. The temperatures that I experienced there were, the lowest was, I think, below 75, and the warmest was 51.
Oh, so you, when it's in a reasonable temperature, you walk 2 kilometers.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I'd walk to work every day, which, of course, wasn't very far. So you could hike around. I got to experience going out on snowmobile at one point. And I do remember one of my very first hikes in Antarctica. You had to go to the fire station to check out with the radio because it's, you know, it's still pretty dark that time of year and very cold. So I went and checked out my radio, and I decided, you know, I'm going to trudge up Observation Hill, and it's going to be great. And it was a pretty steep hill, so I got very sweaty. But as you sweat, my eyelashes started to, like, glue together because they iced over because it was so cold.
No goggles?
I didn't wear goggles. Oh. So I remember having to breathe into my hands to warm up my eyelashes so that they would melt. So that was a new experience for me coming from California.
Oh, goodness.
Well, that's a good age for new experiences, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. And another fun thing I got to do there is the polar plunge. So I actually plunged into the water. They drilled a hole, and it's very slushy because with the salt,
it's melting.
Yeah, it's sort of melting and creates the slush.
Did they have a crane to pull people out who can't handle it?
They did, essentially. Not a crane, but they had the fire crews standing by. You wore a little harness. You sort of throw off your blanket, put on your harness, jump in. And if you needed help getting out,
how long?
Out.
Is it like full immersion or
full immersion? And it was that day that I did it, or night. It was 40 below out, And
I love a cold water plunge, but boy, that's beyond my wildest imagination.
Beyond a certain temperature.
For me, cold water plunge is Peterson's Pits in April, you know? I mean, it's good. It's really good.
It's
okay.
Good. It's good for the immune system.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
after
this polar plunge, was there a thing like a sauna to go into?
There was.
I knew it.
Yes.
I knew it.
So how did it feel?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. It was incredible. Mm. And I couldn't get my shoes back on because my feet were like little bricks of ice. I remember trying to jam my foot in my shoes. They give you this little hut with heaters in it, and you're trying to put your clothes back on. And I think I talked like nonstop for 4 hours. My metabolism was just revved up, and they showed me to a little hot tub that I got to sit in by myself. And this was at the New Zealand base. We didn't have anything like that at our base. That was the one and only time I got to sit in.
Ah, those Kiwis, they know what they're doing.
They do.
I want to remind everybody here that before we had drugs for psychotherapeutic uses and things like that, one of the oldest things that they would do to help with mental health, mostly asylum people who lived in, they would do hot and cold treatments because getting you really cold and then getting you really hot, or the reverse, it makes your circulation just go like crazy, and it is good for your mental health.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the old way to keep from becoming insane.
It's good medicine.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really is.
Well, good. Well, so would you do it again?
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I would love to go again.
I had the harness on, I might try it.
No. Just go down to Antarctica.
Antarctica.
Really?
Oh, it would be so much fun. I'd love to go back. Yeah.
Of course, you would know what you would
do. Well, you can join me at Peterson's Pits next April, okay?
Okay, I'd love to. You're on.
I don't know, Donna. That's pretty exciting for Iowa.
I don't plunge. I kind of creep in. First my feet get used to it, then I slowly, you know. The plunge thing is pretty drastic, though.
I'm not sure I would do that one again, yeah. But you never know.
What a good experience. That's a good thing to share. We're going to talk more with Monica. Well, she's got a whole lot of things to talk about. Why don't we take a little break here? This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Community Radio. Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about Antarctica and other kitchens with Monica Tucker. She spent time in Antarctica, but she's been in other interesting places, too. We'll mention that she has parents that immigrated from Germany, and she had the opportunity to work in a German bakery for a while. That sounds really fulfilling in more ways than one. Tell us about that.
It was very fulfilling in more ways than one, for sure.
What were you baking?
So I didn't actually get to do any of the baking. I just worked at the counter.
You just ate it.
I just ate the food and talked to the people and practiced my German. And in order to bake, you had to go to a trade school. So, you know, Germany is all about the trade schools. And I decided I was in junior college at the time. I'm kind of a late bloomer. I went to school a little bit later in my late 20s, and I was working in an office for the International Education Program And they found out that my parents were from Germany and I didn't really speak German. And they said, oh my God, that's such a shame. You should learn German and you should go on our program. And so I did. I took a year worth of German and I went on their program and ended up in working in a bakery in Tübingen. And I really enjoyed all the pastries.
Western?
That's Southern Germany. Yeah.
Bavarian.
Bavarian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Sounds yummy.
It was very yummy.
Okay, what were the common big sellers, you know?
So we made the pretzels there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those were big sellers. And this meat called Leberkäse, it's like a loaf. It's kind of like what we would think of as bologna. And we would cut off slices of it and put it in this little toaster oven and heat it up. And they would have it on a Brötchen, you know, the little German rolls. And I think even with some butter. At least that's how we did it at home. I can't remember how we did it there. Maybe it was mustard. And then, of course, all
mustard,
the pastries.
Of course, right?
Yes, the German mustard. So Bienenstich was one of my favorite cakes, which is made with honey and, like, I think, like, quark. And quark is what they use for the German cheesecakes. And so that was super yummy. And then all the different pastries, which I can't remember. And
Were you there at Christmas time ever?
I was. I went once at Christmas. And I went to Tübingen, but I also got to go to Munich for Christmas.
I did not understand Christmas until I'd had a Christmas in Munich. Or what do they call it? München. Okay. Anyway. They do Christmas like nobody. I mean, everything is lit. It's like a whole gingerbread world of real people moving around. I mean, it's just beautiful.
How nice.
It's amazing.
How nice. Yeah. And because you grew up in a German household, we were kind of trading some German food Christmas memories. Mm. You talked about something called Rouladen. Am I pronouncing it
yes,
correctly?
Yes, Rouladen. Yeah, that's something my mother used to make. And I had never made it before. And she's been gone quite a long time. And I decided I really wanted to make it. It was one of my favorite foods. And so at the farmer's market that I saw you at a few weeks ago, Lana, we purchased some flat iron steak and took it home and sort of butterflied it out and sliced it up in 8 pieces and pounded it out. And for each piece, you spread some German mustard, a slice of bacon, some chopped onions and chopped pickles, roll it up with some toothpicks, and then you would make a stew out of it, essentially. You want to saute brown the pieces of meat, and then, add everything else that you would into a stew, like some bone broth, some red wine, and
so you're
of course,
braising
the
them.
Braising it. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how thin do you pound the meat down to?
Pretty thin. Yeah. I don't know. Quarter inch? Is that thin?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't cook with a lot of meat, so it was sort of like a maiden voyage.
What did you use?
I think it was the flank steak.
Flank steak.
Could have been the flat iron. I can't remember now. We went back and forth. Which is the best piece? Is it flank, flat iron? Whatever they had.
Right. It's hard to say which one you'd be able to pound as thin. That's very... Wow.
That sounds...
And you cook them with the toothpicks in them?
You do. Yeah, so that they stay together.
I suppose probably people used to tie them up with little strings or
you
something.
You can do string as well. Yeah, I didn't have the string, so
all right.
For the
say
toothpicks.
The stuffing again. So onions...
Mustard.
Pickle.
And bacon.
Pickle and bacon. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I think that sounds pretty good. Sounds delicious to me.
Yeah.
And obviously you're braising them till you don't want them to fall apart. But.
No. So you get them brown on all the sides, and then you take them out and you do saute some onions and carrots and garlic, and then bring them back to the pan, add your bone broth and red wine and
Rouladen
in a Dutch oven, put in the oven, and then later on you make your gravy and serve it with boiled potatoes.
I was going to say, and of course you eat it with potatoes, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the Rotkohl, which is very traditional German.
Rotkohl?
Rotkohl.
K-O-H-L?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Which is red cabbage, which we all know is really purple cabbage. But and it's like a sweet and sour. You cook it with some apple, some cloves, some juniper berries, some vinegar, and a little bit of sugar. And you cook that down for a few hours, and you eat it warm. And it's
yummy.
Just a lovely. It's beautiful on the plate, and it's just brings back so many memories of childhood.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I was thinking of making a cabbage dish for Christmas Day. You know, I mean, and every part of Northern Europe uses cabbage because, of course, that's what you have in the winter. So that sounds like a really good idea. Tell me one more time. So it's sweetened. And
it
what
has
else
a
goes?
A little bit of sugar.
A little sugar.
Apple.
An apple. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then the red wine vinegar.
Red wine vinegar.
So it's sweet and sour and warm. And it's got clove and juniper berry.
Clove and juniper. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Lana, you remember that because I'll call you on the 24th and say, and what did she say to put in it on the Hummer?
Or Donna, you could
re-listen to the podcast.
Again. Yeah, okay.
It's got onion in it as well, too.
Oh,
so
yes,
the onion is sautéed. My mother used to sauté the onion in bacon grease.
Ooh.
And the recipe that I used this time I made it was sauté the onion in butter. So it's a little different flavor. I think I prefer the bacon fat to the butter.
Yeah, well, yeah, it gives the smokiness that you don't get other. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah.
And that's Rotkohl, R-O-T, new word, K-O-H-L.
Huh. Yeah, or it can. I've also seen it as one word.
Oh, okay.
Rotkohl. Okay.
Red cabbage. That sounds like a good winter thing. Other things you want to say about your German kitchen background?
I just remember my omas, they're baking, you know, the German cheesecakes and the Streuselkuchen.
Now, what's a German, how's it different from sort of the American cheesecake?
They don't use cream cheese. They use this thing called quark.
Oh, the quark.
Quark.
Oh,
it's hard to find.
I bet that makes it a little smoother, doesn't it?
It's fluffier. It just has this different texture. It's really nice.
Wow.
And there's not a graham cracker crust. There's actually no crust. I don't remember. I think maybe there is a crust. It's like a wheat crust. Like a regular maybe pie crusty thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I haven't made one. Mm-hmm. It's been years since I've sampled there.
And are they just flavored with like a little vanilla or something?
Yeah, they're not flavored.
No topping? Topping? No topping?
No topping.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, just this yummy, rich, delicious sort of fluffy.
Eggs, too.
Eggs.
Yeah,
yeah,
of course.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's worth an internet search to check that one out.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah. And then the Streuselkuchen, which had the crumble topping, and the bottom was like a yeasted dough, and they'd make them in sheet pans.
Oh.
And they'd either make them with apple slices or plum. So Pflaumenkuchen, Pflaumenstreuselkuchen or Apfelstreuselkuchen.
Now, did you grow up eating these with your grandparents in California?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my mother's parents, they never spoke English. My father, his mother did learn pretty good English. But both of these omas, they were amazing cooks and bakers. And, I was very lucky.
We're going to talk next week about our family's Christmas. But I was thinking, did you guys have goose for Christmas?
No, never.
Okay.
No.
Well, you might want to expand your repertoire to penguin now.
There's no penguins in Germany,
all right.
Okay?
Southern Hemisphere.
I might have goose every now and then. Huh? I remember having goose. Yeah.
But I did eat duck a lot as a child.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my stepfather was a hunter. And he was
in California.
In California. So he would bring home all kinds of things.
It's a small goose, you know?
Yeah.
Well, duck fat and goose fat are both really lovely culinary items. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
Love to hear more about
that. Very good. Well, let's move on to another really good part of your life. You spent much time in Buddhist retreat centers, and not just as a participant. You were kind of part of the workings. You worked in the kitchen there, plus other things. How did you get into the Buddhist way of looking at things?
Interesting. I don't know if it's interesting. It's sort of interesting.
Let's see. Could ask you how you got into the Buddhist kitchens, right?
How did you get there? So after my travels in Antarctica, I traveled through Nepal. I did a trek there, and then I went to Thailand. And you know, before Antarctica, there was this idea that I wanted to go on this spiritual journey and travel somewhere in the world. And so I landed with going to Antarctica. But I still had this idea that I wanted to do this spiritual journey, and meditation was something that I had been attracted to for a long time. And so I did that retreat in Thailand. And then when I went back to California, the following year, after my second year of Antarctica, a friend of mine said, "Oh, they need somebody to do a work retreat at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center," which means you could work in exchange for your retreat time. So I got to like scrub toilets and showers and things. And so I didn't have to pay for the retreat, or I paid a reduced amount. And the retreat was really great. And then I started volunteering there because I had some time during the summer.
Where was this?
Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California in Marin County.
Oh, it's in Marin. Okay.
Yeah. So I was volunteering there, and I was planning to go back to Antarctica. And they offered me a job at the Buddhist center, and I was really struggling, like, Buddhist retreat center, Antarctica, you know, which one of these should I do? And so I finally decided that I really want to explore this Buddhist thing. And so I resigned from my gig at the Antarctic program.
I bet there was a pay differential.
There was a pay differential. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, it was hard to give up the Antarctica gig, and but it was exciting to think about this new possibility. So so I worked in maintenance there. I drove a little golf cart and fixed things, and worked in housekeeping for a while. And the cooks, I just loved walking through the kitchen because they were always just, you know, the smells and just the food that they created was amazing. And I had never been a vegetarian and hadn't been exposed to all this tofu business, and actually enjoyed it. I liked all the tofu that they made. Today, you know, that's not so much. But, lots of tofu and,
Well, you know, I do think I was a vegetarian for a number of years when I was even younger than that. And I have to say that it just changing yourself from the standard American diet for any length of time really opens your eyes up to lots of other possibilities in eating. It's like, you know, even when I stopped being a vegetarian, there were still so many things that I was used to eating that I had learned to like besides, you know, meat and potatoes and broccoli. It's really revelatory to go to some diet that is very different from what you just grew up with. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Always a fun learning curve.
Mm-hmm. And just all the spices and the ways to like make something just taste so delectable.
If you're eating a lot of tofu, you got to season well. Right?
You got to season well.
Good skill. So
and
how
marinate.
How did you make the transition? Did they say, come on, we need help or what?
Yeah. So they didn't. They, it turns out that there was another Buddhist center on the East Coast, which was the sister center, which had started before Spirit Rock. It was started by three teachers, and one of them peeled off and came out to California and started Spirit Rock. So I had talked to some of the teachers there at Spirit Rock and said, what do you think? Should I go out to this other center? And they said, if you really want to bump up your practice, it's more of a serious place to practice.
And where was the other center?
In Massachusetts, in rural Massachusetts, in Barrie. And it just so happens they needed a cook because they were opening a new long-term retreat center where you would go and practice for up to a year. And sometimes people would just come for a month, maybe 6 weeks, 2 months, a year. And so they needed a cook, but they didn't require experience. And so I went out there. And then I originally had said, I'm just not sure I'm going to take the job. I went out to do a look-see. And then they called back and said, well, we really thought you were a good fit. We really want you. And I was like, well, okay. This is the universe is telling me I need to go out here. So,
so how many people averagely were you cooking for in a day?
So I started off in this small retreat center, long-term retreat center, cooking for maybe 40 a day.
Only. And that was, it'll keep you on your toes.
Yeah.
Three meals a day.
It
actually becomes relentless, right?
It is relentless. Mm-hmm. It is. So, but we were only in charge of like cooking one or two of those meals. So if you were on the breakfast shift, then you would help the lunch person. And then the dinner was really simple. But then I went over to our main center and then I was cooking for 135. So that was a little different when it come to lifting those big, hotel pans and big soup pots and
yes,
mm-hmm. yeah.
This is why I'm having shoulder replacements. I lifted too many pots and
many pots.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we'll come back and talk about more good stuff in about vegetarians and cooking for a crowd. This is KHOI Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more information at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. We're talking to Monica Tucker about cooking in a Buddhist retreat center, cooking vegetarian meals in quantity. You mentioned that there were really good cooks there already. Somehow, I would think a Buddhist retreat kitchen would have a little different vibe. I just finished reading a book called Give a Girl a Knife by Amy Thielen, and she talks about some of the high-end, real fancy restaurants in New York City. It sounds like such a cutthroat business. I think the aura in one of the kitchens you worked at was a little different. What sort of help did you have?
I think it was probably very different. The people that come on the retreat are called yogis, and everybody gets a yogi job that they sign up for.
Oh.
And one of the jobs is to help in the kitchen chopping the vegetables, and that's one of the most coveted jobs that people want.
Chop food, carry water?
Absolutely, that's it. So we would have 5 to 6 yogis, and they would come in right after breakfast. We'd set them up in the dining room on the serving tables with all their cutting boards and bring them knives and show them how to properly handle a knife. And then we would show them how each vegetable, how we'd want them cut. And then they would, they'd chop up a pile of celery.
Sounds like more work than doing it yourself.
It was great to have them do it, though, to have all the vegetables chopped and piles of it sitting in the kitchen when it's time to cook. Sometimes you'd get these really wacky pieces that were like, oh, my God, we have to recut these because way too big. But mostly they did a pretty decent job and not too many cuts.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say that. So one time I cooked at Esalen, which is a big retreat center.
Yeah.
Okay, the door on the kitchen says, be careful. We play with fire and carry knives.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Dangerous place.
So cooking is cooking, even in the retreat centers. It's not that different from a restaurant.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Kitchens are hot, and mm-hmm. sometimes personalities mm-hmm. run hot as well.
It's like a dance in a lot of ways. You mm-hmm. do have to have body awareness of everyone moving around you. Because often, somebody, and the thing in the kitchen, they go, behind you, that means turn around and be careful. Because they can be, or hot pot, you call out, and because it is dangerous, especially with hot things. So,
that sense of team and all of the moving bodies that always happens in kitchens where people are working together. It's actually quite, as long as everybody's really trained enough to be aware of other people, it really can be quite delightful.
Yeah.
Talking about body awareness, before we started this, before we went on the air, I learned a new thing. We're talking about different ways of eating food. The different Buddhist traditions have different ways of sitting down and meeting your meal, and some rules and some practices for how you consume food. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So in the Theravadan tradition, they do discuss mindful eating, and usually at the beginning of a retreat, especially at sort of an intro retreat, they'll do the mindful eating meditation. So they'll give everybody a raisin and have them just hold it in their mouth on their tongue and really savor it and just take some time. And then they might, you know, say just start tasting it and start chewing it and, you know, just really appreciate what's happening in your mouth, and then the experience of swallowing. And so then they really recommend you eating your meals that way and just eating in a mindful, slow way. And I remember in Thailand, it was kind of excruciating, you know, like chew and swallow. And the teacher would be there with you and sort of watching you. So you couldn't gobble your food. You couldn't go quickly. And in the Zen tradition, it's very different. They have this thing called Orioki, which I think
when Monica and I first came into the studio together, I asked her, because hardly anyone has ever heard of this thing called Orioki, and I once was cooking for a bunch of Buddhists, and I had to cook. So it's this system, and every person comes with their Orioki kit, basically, which is their own napkin, and I think it's a set of three bowls and probably chopsticks, and they... you know, you start out with a little bundle, the bowls are piled up and the napkin is tied around it and it sits in front of you. And then the reason I had to learn, because in the kitchen you have to cook, it comes in three courses. There has to be a liquid soup course, then there has to be a rice meal, and then there's some other, you know, vegetable thingy or whatever. But the point of the whole thing is to use the, you know... It's been a while, but what is it? You end up with the soup washing all the bowls out. You end up cleaning your plate and eating it in an order so that you end up with three clean bowls and everything's empty. So nobody washes dishes. You clean your own bowls, finishing with the soup, and then tie it back up in your napkin, and there it is for the next meal. Something like that.
Something like that. But I think they give you a little cup of water. Maybe somebody comes around and pours it in your bowl or something. I haven't seen it. I've only heard about it.
I can't. So. You know, I'm sorry, but it's been a long... All I know is that I had to cook the three different parts, and one was always like a clear soup, usually miso or something like that.
Yeah.
Orioki.
Orioki, yeah.
I have that word is way stuck into my memory bank. So.
Well, that's good to be mindful of what you're eating and... Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of ways to do that.
Having a teacher there watching me, I think it'd be a little intimidating. But we can learn. We can learn. That's good.
No worse than sitting at the table with a strict mother who's going, clean your plate.
Eat your peas.
Yeah. Sit still. Quit wiggling.
Stop poking your brother. I remember that sort of thing. That's good, too. Well, what were some of the things that you cooked, you said you kind of moved away from just tofu, and there was tempeh things. And what were some of the favorite things you liked to cook?
Right, you're Buddhist raw vegetarian.
Buddhist raw vegetarian?
No. Yours, the ones you cooked for, were vegetarian.
Vegetarian, yeah. All vegetarian. Sorry, I didn't hear what you said. Mm-hmm. Yes, all vegetarian. So some of my favorite things to cook were the tempeh dishes, and not everybody liked tempeh. We had one teacher, in fact, he would come through the kitchen and he would say, you know, I just really hate tempeh. I'm like, well, you're probably going to want to go out to lunch then today, because today is tempeh marbella, which is a dish I really loved because it's an Italian dish. And
does it have prunes in it?
It has prunes. Whoa! I know.
No, I keep going. What
and
else is
olives,
it?
Like Kalamata olives.
It's like chicken marabella, but it's with tempeh.
It is with tempeh. And capers. And then I would use lots of fresh herbs like parsley and basil. And let's see, what else was in that? And then you make the marinade out of tamari and some red wine vinegar and lots of garlic. And then sometimes I would also add in some cooking sherry.
I'm trying to wrap my brains around tempeh and prunes, but, you know, okay.
Right, yeah, yeah. It's sort of odd, but then once it's all cooked and kind of mushed together and then
you... Tastes like chicken.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Well, no,
I
give it a try.
Start with chicken marabella first so you know what you're doing.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, do the chicken. It's really good with chicken thighs, actually.
Well, so if you make it with chicken, does it have prunes in it?
It does.
Yes.
See? Yeah. Donna, you'd like it.
I know how that works, but the switching of the tempeh in that instance, just kind of my brain went, whoop. Okay, I can see how it would work, you know. But,
well, yeah. Tastes like chicken.
We have ideas of how things should taste, don't we? Goodness. So you got used to cooking for lots of people. Do you still kind of think in big quantities when you go into the kitchen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do sometimes. It's a little bit hard to back off on some things.
Oh, it is. I always cook too much. I can't help myself.
Have the friends and neighbors in. We like people like you guys.
Yeah, there's always leftover. Well, also, you start to feel if you don't have some leftovers, you haven't made enough anyway, so...
Absolutely. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Monica, you shared something with me, and you called it a bread, but it kind of looked like a brownie. It was kind of like a bar you cut. It was very dense and dark, and it had little chunkies in it. So I thought, well, maybe it's a molasses kind of brownie. But it was really good. It tasted so good for me that I couldn't believe it. Tell me what I was eating.
Yeah, so that's a recipe I found out about maybe a decade ago called Life Changing Bread, and different cooks I knew were sort of sending
Is
around
it
the
sweet
recipe.
Is it savory?
It's actually savory, mm-hmm. but I put a little bit of fennel in it, which I think Ooh. Gives it kind of that sweetness, mm-hmm. and it has like a tablespoon of maple syrup in it, but it's made up of oats, nuts, seeds. Including, what are those things called? Those little black seeds.
Chia poppy?
Chia seeds. Yeah, chia seeds, ground flax, psyllium. So, you know, it's got all that stuff to help loosen things up in there. So you put all the ingredients together. It's got some coconut oil in it and water. And then you kind of let it sit out all night so the...
So it's not baked.
So it will sprout, and then you bake it the next day.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, again, this just good stuff for people having good thoughts and...
And good everything. Good innards after you have that, I suppose.
We appreciate you being with us today, Monica. Talked about your adventures in many different places, so... Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking
Happy
to,
holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. Talking to Monica Tucker. Very good. So, Donna, tell folks about our podcast.
Oh, right. So, whatever you just heard on the radio live also goes into a podcast format, which will be put up wherever you listen to your podcasts. Under Donna Lana Kitchen, that's one word, DonnaLonna, second word, kitchen, every Thursday. There's a new one every Thursday. So
if I get around to it, and I will, because this was good. Great. Mm-hmm. Thanks to our audience, and thanks to our guest. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live every Tuesday, repeated 7 p.m. in the evening, or as Donna said, on a podcast or on this radio station's website. Very good. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. You heard Dinky's Rio and Siobhan O'Donnell. Yes, we did. Very good. Support this fine radio station. Become a member, khoifm.org/membership. My name is Lana Octigo.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.